Okay, so our next speaker is Lars Chicka, who's Professor of Sensory and Behavioral Ecology in Queen Mary University of London. He's done absolutely wonderful experimental research on cognition in arthropods, especially bees, research which suggests incredibly, a lot of people are not that familiar with insect cognition research, but which suggests that bees can form false memories. That was a very recent paper. Count landmarks, learn sameness-difference rules, and even translate these sameness-difference rules across sensory modalities, and many other impressive cognitive feats. And the key question, as Lars see it, if I can channel him for a second, is not how can such small brain animals do such sophisticated cognitive things, but rather why did some animals need to evolve such large brains at all, given how much can be done with small ones? Not only did Lars travel all the way across the pond, as many other speakers so graciously did, but he also gave up his tickets to a Bob Dylan concert in London to come here today. And we are forever, forever grateful for that. So please welcome Lars. Thank you very much.
Okay. Thank you very much for this very kind introduction. I did actually manage to sell them for a while. Without a prophet.
Okay. For a prophet.
Okay. You might be slightly disappointed to hear that I'm not going to answer this question, though, but I'll leave you with some more questions in the same direction. before we move into cognition, I just wanted to make you aware that, or remind you, so far as you're not already aware, that there's all kinds of stuff that social insects do within their innate behavioral repertoires that actually the vast majority of even interesting vertebrates, such as the guys that you guys study, can't do. So there are these fantastic termite skyscrapers with a very sophisticated system of climate control and mist fins, these mathematically perfect hexagonal honeycombs, phenomena such as agriculture and division of labor, and these sort of collective bridge-building phenomena you find in weaver ants, and of course the symbolic language that you find within the honeybee dance. Now if we turn to... So what insects can generate in terms of effective miniaturization is often very impressive. So here's these miniature parasitoid wasps. Some of them, their entire body size is smaller than a single-celled paramecium in this particular case. Some of them spend their entire growth period inside butterfly eggs. And of course, nonetheless, these individuals must generate the entire behavioral repertoire that much larger and much larger-brained insects must also do. So locomotion, finding a mate, finding an oviposition site, and indeed short and long-term memory are all found in these little insects in just the same way as in much larger-brained insects. Now, I'm glad that no one's actually boasted so far about how their particular favorite critter is the most intelligent animal that exists, so I can do that. here's something about bee cleverness that probably you haven't seen yet. So this is a glass table, and these artificial flowers are underneath it, and she can't crawl underneath, so she has to pull a string in order to access the flower. And what we're currently doing, this is more like a little more than a flea circus, because we're interested in the cultural transmission of this phenomenon. The question is, if you seed a colony with a single knowledgeable individual, then how fast does the skill spread? And it turns out very rapidly. Within 2 or 3 days, all the members of a colony can do it.
I need a copy of that paper.
It isn't in any paper yet. So there are two more big questions, or I think they're big, but I'm going to answer neither of them. Is how do such little brains achieve these kinds of cognitive feats? And indeed, are these feats in any way computational demanding? Are they difficult? Are they hard to make over an evolutionary timescale? And so on. And I'll speculate a bit in that direction. So here's a bee brain. I'm glad it's already been introduced to some extent, but I'll talk you through the main components. So here are the These are the antennae, so there are these nose, those are the eyes. There are three optic ganglia, the lamina, medulla, and lobula. These sort of telephone dial structures are the antennal lobes, the primary relays for processing olfactory information. And these up here are the mushroom bodies, these blue structures that are thought to function in the context of learning and memory. By the way, the first observation, I guess the first expression of the social brain hypothesis was in 1850 by Félix Dujardin, who observed that these mushroom bodies were larger in social insects than they were in their solitary companions. Now, it turns out that he was wrong, but the idea was clearly an interesting one, and it was certainly 100 years before anyone said something similar about primates. Certainly Robin Dunbar wasn't the first. Now, bee brains are small, as I pointed out just now, so that they have about or less than a million neurons, which makes them, in a sense, better subjects to access on a neural level how cognition might be implemented mechanistically, and that's all the more so since, at least in Drosophila, for example, a relatively large fraction of the connectome has by now been mapped. And that's the largest percentage that you find in any animal other than C. elegans. Now, nonetheless, so that's Anshin Jiang's work, was working, I think, continuing to work on generating the full connectome. I guess what this figure also suggests, so if anyone tells you that insect brains are simple, then that's clearly nonsense. So they might be simpler than those of many larger-brained animals, but this isn't sort of a simple wiring diagram. Quite clearly, it's very complicated. But we're starting to make some progress in identifying how these the neural connections that are already known might underpin cognition in these insects. Now, as I said, one important question is how complex are certain cognitive tasks? And I guess one way in which you could answer that question is how much neural circuitry do you minimally need in order to mediate a given task? So we did this sort of fun experiment. It was actually half sci-art, half science. An experiment where we sort of erected these large pyramid-shaped landmarks in an otherwise relatively featureless territory. And bees have to count off. So the hive was somewhere over here. Food was after the third tent. And so bees flew that back and forth several times, and then we altered the array so that we produced a conflict between the correct number of landmarks and the entrained distance. And it turned out that the more landmarks we put in the way of the bee, in the way of the bees, the earlier as a group the bees would tend to land. If we reduce the number of landmarks, they'd fly further. So it's a kind of proto-counting or numerosity-related. Now, how much does that cost in neural terms, minimally? So here's a model by Stanislas de Haan and Changeux in 1993, where they sort of used a roughly primate-inspired network and found that they need about 530 different neural units in order to count up to 7 in with 100% reliability. 530, okay? You could stick that in a Drosophila brain and you wouldn't notice any difference. It isn't a lot. You don't need much neural substrate to do counting. Counting looks clever. In computational terms, it isn't. Now, similarly, what you need for face recognition. So we did this. It's another kind of semi-fun experiment where we faced honeybees with a textbook test on prosopagnosia, where human subjects can't remember or recall human faces. So we used the same faces from that textbook test, trained bees to associate a little sugar reward with one face and then face them with a series of other faces to see how well they might discriminate the alternatives from that entrained face. And the fact was that for most faces, roughly 80%, so they were pretty good at that task. Now, that doesn't mean bees recognize faces as faces. For a bee, that's just a strange flower. It's a pattern that's associated with the reward, and that's all there is. Now, in some social insects, some species of wasps that have been especially thoroughly investigated by Liz Tibbetts and collaborators, they do biologically use individual face recognition. These wasps have a linear hierarchy where there's one top alpha female that monopolizes all the reproduction, and then a sort of string of subordinate individuals underneath. These positions in the hierarchy are determined by fights, and whoever wins all the fights becomes the alpha queen, and so on. And the fights are costly, so they can get severely injured, sometimes killed in these fights, so it's a good idea to remember whom you can win against and whom not, and then basically stay at the position that you're at, unless there's evidence to the contrary. And that's what they use the face recognition for. It turns out that these wasps are specialized face recognizers, in that they're better at recognizing faces as predictors of danger and safety in such elegant wine maze experiments that Liz Tibbetts did, and do better at that task than related wasps that don't biologically have to engage in face recognition. Now again, that might appear to us as complex because it seems to us perhaps that individual recognition is the glue that holds human societies together. But again, you might ask in computational terms, how complex is it? So here's a view of the Mona Lisa as an insect might see it, the picture of Simon Laughlin, which by coincidence corresponds to a minimal neural network for face recognition generated by H.K. McDonald's, who used roughly the same pixelation for face images and asked, can they do reliable face recognition with a relatively minimal layer of 1024 receptors, so that's your pixels, and then about 550 interneurons and two output neurons that decide correct face, incorrect face. With that network, okay, that's the largest fraction of that is the receptors themselves, a few hundred neurons, you could get completely reliable face recognition for 100 faces. Okay, face recognition, again, at that level, just recognizing images is not a difficult task. It's easy. It's especially easy if you already have a visual system that allows you to recognize patterns, perhaps in the context of prey recognition and so on, and then you just tweak it and wire it into a different context. Now, given what I've just said, you might be unsurprised to learn that in terms of gross neural anatomy, these face-recognizing wasp species actually do not display any difference to non-face-recognizing wasp species. So Liz Tibbetts teamed up with Wolfie Gromenberg to slice up these brains and measure volumes of mushroom bodies, various parts of the visual system and so on. And long story short, these are the face-recognizing wasp species. These are two closely related, same genome. Non-face recognizing ones. And there's no difference in the visual system whatsoever. Not in terms of gross neuroanatomy. There's not a face recognition module in these wasps. So presumably the circuits that are already in existence for recognizing features of prey or landmarks are just co-opted into a different circuitry, so that into a different behavioral context without there being a separate module to mediate these tasks. So just to sum that up, my view is, so far as I've explored the literature, the task that requires a big brain, the cognitive task that requires a big brain, has not yet been discovered. Okay, there's interesting work from all kinds of fronts, including robotics, for example. Maura Shanahan, who collaborates with Nikki, for example, does these fantastic robotics models where robots predict the outcomes of their own actions, which in my view is a good criterion for consciousness, for example, with about 1,000 neurons. Okay, so you can do consciousness with relatively limited number, bare bones consciousness, but still with relatively limited neuron numbers. Now, these models that I've just talked about, including the robotic ones, are interesting in their own right. They generate useful null hypotheses as to what you might minimally need computational to mediate certain tasks. But of course, they don't tell you anything about how real animals do it, because in these cases, these models are made to replicate certain tasks. Okay, they work because you've made them work, but not because how animals make them work. So what we're trying to do currently with Mark Roper and Faye Hunter is try to generate models based entirely on empirical neurobiological information without any input into what they should behaviorally achieve, then essentially pump information through these networks and ask what kind of capacities pop out of them if we feed only neurobiological information into these models. So here in the lamina, the first optic ganglion, there's fortunately fairly good information about the types of branching patterns that receptors have, and the monopolar cells. In other ganglia, the information is more sketchy. So this is Mark Roper's lamina model, so it's a complete circuitry diagram fed by only neurobiological information. Further up, in the lobula, for example, there's one distinct class of, with two subclasses of interneurons that are repeatedly found, so-called orientation-sensitive neurons that respond either more strongly through this to this direction of edges or this particular direction of edges. And so Mark built this relatively comprehensive model of the BE visual system with receptors, small field edge detectors in the medulla, large field edge detectors in the lobula, and fed these into the higher order learning center for the mushroom bodies in sort of connectivities that are entirely empirically determined. Now, there's a huge literature from Adrian Horridge and Martin Jorfer and Rudy Gavener and so on from starting from the 50s all the way to now on the kinds of patterns that bees can discriminate and the ones that they can't do. So they're pretty good at some things that look seemingly very complex, such as comparing these two. There are some others where surprisingly, even though the patterns seem to be fairly distinct, they seem to fail. Now, one way of viewing a good model or the quality of a model might be, okay, we've got a model that predicts with a lot of accuracy what we see in real behavior. Now, these particular the points that you see here are all different kinds of models, different ways of wiring up these lobular orientation sensitivity sensitive neurons with the mushroom bodies. Each color is a different model, and the different dots represent behavioral performance and model prediction. So this, for example, this particular pattern was discriminated in real behavior with about 60% probability, and with by the model also about 67% or something there. Now, so as I said, what traditionally would be viewed as a good model is if all your dots are on the line. Yeah. Now that's not what we see. What we see here is in fact that whatever model we use to wire up these orientation sensitive neurons with the mushroom bodies, the model performs better than the real bee. Okay. Now, you should bear in mind that these models are so simple as to be complete caricatures of what's likely to be going on. We have an extreme reduction. We only use two orientation-sensitive detectors, nothing about color. There's no retinotopy. There's no image anywhere in the bee's brain in this model. Just two very, very simple feature detectors. With two super simple feature detectors, you can do better than a real bee does in a behavioral experiment. Okay? So you can do a lot of pattern recognition that seemingly looks clever with just the simple most feature detectors that you could imagine. So there is, I think, a sort of view in the animal cognition literature that there are distinct classes of behavioral affordances that are either classical conditioning on the one hand or magic on the other. And I'm not entirely sold that a lot of things that are complex cognition necessarily are that complex. All you need for many of the abilities that we've heard about in your very kind introduction, sameness, difference tasks, pattern classifications and so on, actually don't need any cleverness. All they need is, at some neural level, an ensemble code that reliably is different for one class of object than for another. That's all you need. Now, Fei Pang has done an interesting mushroom body model that replicates quite a number of behavioral or cognitive capacities that are described in the bees as well. But again, depending entirely on empirically determined information. In some cases, because there's more information from flies, we have to sort of patch our models together. So one of the defining features of projection neurons from the olfactory periphery to the mushroom body in Drosophila, we don't know this yet in bees, is randomness. Okay, the projection neurons are randomly connected to the Kenyan cells in the mushroom bodies. There's sparse coding, so a few hundred projection neurons feed into about 100,000 or 170,000 Kenyan cell neurons. So lots of Kenyan cells, very big hard drive, very few projection neurons that feed into it. And there's learning memory plasticity at both the input level to the mushroom bodies as well as the output level. So here's a mushroom body, that little block here. These three colors are olfactory projection neurons. The sparseness is represented by there being only three projection neurons in this case and a larger number of Kenyan cells. Here are the output neurons that ultimately control behavior via some intermediate center. So there's plasticity both here as well as here, and that's simply modeled by synaptic weights changing to the positive if the bees receive a reward in phase model, and they are reduced if there's a punishment in association with a certain conditioned stimulus. And he then asks, again, using only neurobiological information, what kind of a behavior pops out of these circuitries when tested. And one of the features that he explored was peak shift. So if you train bees to a particular odor, represented here as an arbitrary value of 0.5 on that scale, then there's a generalization to some extent to both sides, and that the behavioral response falls off from the peak response. If you use differential conditioning, so you give them a reward for this value and a punishment for this one, then the bee will choose something that's not the rewarded, but further away from the rewarded stimulus in the direction of that's set by the direction between reward and punishment. So that's been described in some accounts as a kind of rule learning, that you don't choose an absolute stimulus, you just choose something relatively further away from the reward to avoid the punishment at the same time. But it turns out that it actually isn't that complex. So in phase model, here's the Kenyan cell output to both in terms of absolute and differential conditioning, you find the peak at the rewarded level. But at the extrinsic neuron response, using just these simple principles of sparse coding and changing synaptic weights according to rewards and punishment in the same linear ways, is you get a peak shift of just the same kind as the behavioral affordance in the extrinsic neuron response. So that's the red curve here. If you compare that to Jerry Wright's behavioral results, so that's real behavior, that's phase model, that's not in any way adjusted to replicate the behavior. You can do that simple rule learning easily with just the most primitive random connections between projection neurons and a few simple learning rules. By the way, this model can also replicate phenomena such as negative patterning conditioning, positive patterning conditioning, and so on. So a whole range of seemingly cognitive phenomena pop out of the most simple circuitries that you could imagine. Now, in terms of evolvability, I can't say much about that, but given what I've just said, you might be unsurprised that I suspect that evolving cognitive capacity in general is relatively easy. There's a good overview of how simple it is to evolve novel behavior routines by very slight tweakings of neural circuitries by Paul Katz. This is not about cognition, but behavior. There was an interesting paper just the other week about C. elegans, where some workers found the default variant is hermaphrodite, but there are also males in these guys, and of course their connectome is fairly well characterized. However, they found two new male neurons that in this case were generated from glial progenitors. Okay, they become neurons from after already being glial cells, and these neurons mediate sex-specific learning behaviors in the male worms. Just two neurons essentially turn an animal that's otherwise programmed to forage into one that can learn in the context of mate search. Now, I wish there were more such studies. Here's a classic one of the things that you'd ideally like to do in order to ask how evolvable cognition is selection experiments. Here's a classic experiment on simple associative learning in Drosophila, where over two dozen generations, Loftel and co-authors selected flies for conditionability and found extremely drastic effects after about 10-15 generations in terms of conditionability. Now, that's not evolving a new capacity. No one's done that to my knowledge. But of course, at least with our bees, whatever behavioral paradigm we test, there's huge variation between individuals. And if you could use organisms that lend themselves better to selection experiments than our bees, then I think such experiments would be very rewarding. Now, here's a somewhat peculiar figure from Bolles and Wynne from a 2009 Nature paper, where I think they were essentially surprised by the fact that parrots could do some things that humans can, but primates can't. So I guess they were essentially surprised by there being convergence at all. I guess in this conference, no one will be too surprised by that. But I think given... So here's a slight modification of that slide. I think that given that it's very likely relatively easy to tweak your cognitive capacities depending on environmental requirement, there's another central tenet of evolutionary biology that might not easily not as easily lend itself to the evolution of cognition as many people think. And that central tenet is that if you observe something a trait that's the same in two related species, then that must mean that the ancestor already had it. Now, so that's the scenario here. You find culture, you find something like culture in chimps. So even assuming that they really are the same traits, and as we heard earlier, that's not necessarily always the case, but let's assume they are, then the assumption is culture must have evolved here. Now, I think that idea rests fundamentally on the idea that the trait is difficult to evolve. Okay, if it's not difficult to evolve, if you can make the trait from scratch in 50 generations, then you might easily have convergence even in closely related species, especially if it might proceed along similar paths, as of course we know from molecular genetic studies on a variety of levels is actually not unlikely. So conclusions, I think, for now I don't see any clear constraints of small nervous systems on a variety of cognitive abilities, at least insofar as they've been explored with neural network models or more sort of realistic computational neuroscience models. I think that we need, rather than to, and I think there have been a number of approaches, interesting approaches today to this, I think we too many people in comparative cognition, I think, get too easily carried away with animals being clever. I think we need to find ways to quantify cognitive complexity. In some ways, whatever they are, in terms of sequential processing stages, in terms of parallel processes needed, in some sensible computational terms, rather than just saying, well, that looks really clever just because it's human-like. I think an obvious question we need to explore is how easy is it, or difficult, is it to evolve certain cognitive capacities. My view from... That's guesswork, admittedly, from what we're just exploring. My view is that if you have selection pressure to generate certain cognitive capacities, then you're going to get them, very likely. So in terms of asking the question of how easy it is to evolve new cognitive capacities, I guess one important question is to what extent can you co-opt existing circuits and reuse them and tweak them to co-opt them into novel behavior routines. But you might also, of course, in some cases especially where you can't tolerate interference, need to perhaps duplicate modules, perhaps sometimes multiple times, and then evolve or tweak each one of them to a particular behavior context. I'll stop with Moravec's paradox, because that's something... I don't know if biologists are aware of this, but computer scientists and information people are well aware of this this observation, that it is, as Moravec put it, it's comparatively easy to make computers exhibit adult level performance on intelligence tests or playing checkers, and difficult or impossible to give them the skills of a 1-year-old when it comes to perception and mobility. All right, thanks very much.